The House Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. Representative Moran moves the minutes from March 6, 2018. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 6, 2018, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. We will first take up House File 2996, Representative Kreisha. As he makes his way forward, Representative Kreisha moves that House File 2996 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Representative Kreisha, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I have with me Dr. Tracy Laliberte, who is going to help me introduce the bill, because, frankly, she's been a big part of putting this together and knows way more about this stuff than I do. Members, just by way of introduction, House File 2996 is the Training Academy for Child Protection Social Workers. The piece that came out of the Child Protection Task Force 4 years ago was training that we never were able to address. And so now we are finally in a position where we have agreement. I believe we have the right piece of legislation, the right program going forward, so we need to address that. You've heard many stories about the workers and getting them training and keeping them involved so that we don't have a high turnover. So with that, I'm going to let my testifiers do most of the talking, and then I'll stand for questions at the end. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Laliberte.
Dr. Laliberte, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Tracy Laliberte, and I work at the University of Minnesota in the School of Social Work. And this bill really came about, as Representative Kreisha said, as part of the governor's task force. Of the 93 recommendations that were made, more than 10% of those recommendations direct our attention to training. And there hasn't been any concrete movement in that, and the current training system is woefully underfunded. I know that's always an issue, but it isn't meeting the needs, and there's been quite a bit of testimony in other committees about that as well, and the crisis that the workforce is facing. When the crisis of a workforce occurs, many fields have that, but in this field of child protection, that means the safety of kids and families. So what we're really talking about is being able to scale up the training in the state of Minnesota to be comparable to other states. I did provide some slides to just give the committee some background, and if you reference, I believe it's the third slide, it's a comparison of the current training system compared to other like states so that you understand what the need of this bill really is. If you look at the top in the left, you see Minnesota. That represents the number of kids that are served in the state of Minnesota, and it compares to Colorado, Washington, and Pennsylvania. I will focus on Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania is very similar to Minnesota in the number of kids who are served, as well as the fact that it's a county-operated state oversight state, so it's very similar to ours. In the middle column, you'll see we have 14 staff dedicated to training the entire state of Minnesota. That compares to 100 staff in Pennsylvania. We put in $2.5 million to training, which is about $71 per child served, and the state of Pennsylvania puts in $12.5 million at about $350 per kid served. So you can see that, you know, while we may not need to be Pennsylvania, we are woefully behind in terms of the service that we're delivering to the workforce, who then we want to have the most effective service delivered to kids and families. If you look at the next slide that looks very, very similar, I guess it's the fifth slide perhaps, the proposed training system brings us into alignment, and you can see how the numbers have changed for Minnesota. It would bring us to about 60 staff, training staff, to be able to cover the state, and this would be a regional model. So the counties, the outstate counties would not have to drive. It's not metro-centric. County training would be delivered in a fashion that's in alignment with adult learning principles. It's not just a train and go. It's a very comprehensive wraparound training that also supports the secondary trauma that this particular workforce is facing, which has resulted in a 25% turnover rate. So at a 25% turnover rate, as the state has been training people in the last 2 years, they are retraining one out of every four people for the same position at about $54,000 per turnover. That's tremendously disruptful to kids and families. So when your constituents call and talk about the fact that they've been stuck in court continuance after continuance and their kids can't come home, it's because, in part, some of that worker turnover is impacting the services delivered to kids as well as the ability to move cases effectively through the court process. The bill itself that's in front of you really outlines two distinct things. One is the training academy itself. This academy needs to be constructed, and it's proposed that it is a comprehensive partnership, a state university partnership. This is a model that's been studied across the country that has borne good research results in terms of outcomes for the learning of the workforce and the stability in reducing turnover, which improves outcomes for kids and families. It also brings in a variety of new types of training and support for the workforce. Beyond the training system itself, there's three studies that are outlined in this bill. One looks at the workforce and the stability of the workforce, and that's repeated every 2 years. And that is to continue to monitor how we are doing with the turnover and be able to look at outcomes of training. The second study looks at workload. At this point in time, there's no administrative data that would be able to tell you, you know, if a worker in Pipestone has 14 cases and a worker in Hennepin County has 17 cases, are those comparable? Because counties count cases somewhat differently, and our systems don't really track the workload. So we have to do a study to be able to understand that. And that's important in terms of knowing, are we staffing correctly, and what do the counties need to do to make change. The third study in the final part of this bill is an outcome study. It links data from a number of areas to be able to understand the the outcomes and experiences of very complex kids and families as they move through the system, and how we can connect that back to turnover and training. So it's the training academy and then those three separate studies that really make up this bill.
And Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have my second testifier, who is Nicole Neames from Polk County.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher and committee members. My name is Nicole Neames, and I'm the Director of Human Services for Polk County. I'm here today representing MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. I've worked in county human services for 19 years. I started out as a child protection worker. I was a child protection supervisor for 6 years, and I've been a human services director for the last 7 years. I'm here today to represent MACSA in expressing our support for quality training resources and supports for child welfare workers in Minnesota, and I would like to thank Representative Crescia for bringing forward this bill. In order to provide quality services, a stable and well-trained workforce is needed. Quality training and ongoing supports are needed to build that quality workforce. New workers are inexperienced and unprepared to jump right into complex child welfare matters. They need training, direction, and practice to support and support to gain the skills and confidence they need. A well-prepared worker has received an appropriate level of training, have practiced their skills, and have supervisory oversight and support. This takes some time. Training that includes simulations allows a new child protection worker the opportunity and experience to practice real-life scenarios in a simulation environment. This is a huge benefit for new workers as it creates a safe environment for trial and error and provides feedback, direction, and guidance prior to providing actual services in the community. Ongoing training and access to mentoring and coaching are also needed for experienced workers to continue to grow professionally and stay on top of best practices. Staff turnover results in increased caseload sizes for child protection workers who are left to cover the workload of their colleagues who have left. When new CP workers are hired, the existing agency staff already have a larger than normal caseload from covering those cases, and then they're also there to participate in and support new workers in being trained. all of the responsibilities to deliver the mandated services and statutorily driven services fall on the shoulders of the workforce. However, our workforce is unstable and turning over at a high rate. When experiencing high turnover, human services agencies do their best, but the constant churn and change does not allow for delivery of the highest possible level services. In meeting with and looking at other child welfare training systems across the country, there is a training and support being provided that has increased workforce stability by decreasing staff turnover. Properly training and supporting our new CP workers will lead to retention, and retention leads to well-trained senior staff that positively impact agency stability and thus reduce turnover and increase workforce stability throughout the state of Minnesota. Regional training centers also reduce travel time and costs to counties, as well as creating a positive training relationship within the region. Thank you for your time today, and again, MAXA would like to express our support for quality training, for resources and supports for child welfare workers in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Names, for your testimony this morning. Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have another testifier, Eric Jane from Ramsey County, who's a social worker. And while he's coming down, members, just one little thing that will stick in your mind that why this bill is important. If we were to hire a social worker right now, today in March, they would not start training until August. They would be getting caseloads. They would be dealing with families. They would be working with kids without any training. This bill would start the training right away. So think about that. If you have a constituent or you have a family that goes through a child protection services, those social workers may not be even into the training yet if they're that new. That's how severe the problem we have is. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Chair. My name is Eric Jane. I work at Ramsey County Child Protective Services. I work in the program unit. My role is to try to reunify families once children have been removed or if removal has not happened, to sustain the child in the home by providing supportive services and referrals. I'm also here on behalf of AFSCME and social workers, and I'd also like to point out that March is Social Work Month, and we've got a lot of incredible social workers I work with at Ramsey County. I know that we have amazing social workers around the state of Minnesota. I'd like to segue from where we left off here. My own personal experience, my own personal story is that I was hired in December of 2015, December 14th, 2015, by my first case the week after, and then I got my first court-involved case on Christmas Eve. So that'd be December 24th. That's 10 days after. Very intense case, lots of complexities. I had zero training at that point. So my training began in April of 2016. By then, I already had about eight cases by then, very, very complex cases. Along with these eight cases, there's multiple collateral contact that has to be connected with. We have ongoing contact. We need to monitor very serious situations. We've got court-related issues. Because many of those cases that I had were in court, unfortunately, I was not able to do the full training that I needed to do. I had to leave a couple of times to take care of business. So, unfortunately, because I already had those cases involved before I was fully trained in, it made the training a very arduous and inefficient experience. Our families in Minnesota, the children that we work with in Minnesota, if we really want to do right by them, it's important for them to have social workers who have been properly trained. It's important for them to have social workers that aren't inundated with 40 hours of paperwork a week alone. We have to make sure that these kids, who are very lovable and very valuable, are getting good quality services by us. It's important that the state monitors what our caseload size is. Currently, my own personal experience is I have 20 on my caseload. I believe that the recommendation from the legislative task force is 10. So I'm not a mathematician. I'm a social worker, but you know, I think that's double of what the recommended caseload is. So I would encourage us to really look at the issues here of what we can do to do right by the families we work with and get our caseload size down to a manageable place so that we can give the children the services that they deserve so that we can strengthen families here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Jane, for your testimony. Representative Frisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't have any other testifiers. My final point, and then there, if there's other testifiers, but on the last slide, I know we don't handle the money in here, so we'll talk about this in Bitcoin. But if you look at the bottom of the budget, when we invest $5.4 million, we get $2.7 of that back the next year from the federal. So we're not... This is a great investment for us, and we're actually leaving money on the table by not taking advantage of this. And you can see that continues to grow again in Bitcoin for this community, this committee.
Thank you, Representative Crescia, for that. Are there any questions for this series of testifiers? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Crescia, referring back to slide number 3, where there was a comparison with Pennsylvania, and I know that this is just part of the task force work, you know, the product of it. Why is there about a 2.5 times higher rate of children receiving CPS in Minnesota compared to Pennsylvania? Because it's about the same size of population receiving, but Pennsylvania is, you know, 2.5 times larger. Is there something else in the system that is a delta that we have a higher rate of, I guess, need for CPS intervention?
Representative Frisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. Just looking at this purely, if I'm getting your question right, and that is we have the same amount of children being represented, but Pennsylvania has a larger service. They have more personnel serving them. Is that what you're asking, what the delta is there?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, the total population of Pennsylvania is about 2.5 times the population of the state of Minnesota. Approximately the same number of, you know, children per household would mean that they have a 2.5 times lower rate of intervention by CPS. And because this is one of the products coming out of the task force, I'm wondering what is the factor. Are they doing something different that they, you know, have, we're 250% rate that they are of needing CPS intervention?
Representative Crescia.
Thank you. Now I understand the question. Thank you, Representative Quam. What this really comes down to is they have a higher referral rate. We have a higher referral rate, with our reforms, and a lot of this has to do with the boots on the ground, the people that we have. We're getting more referrals in. We're screening them more stringently because of reforms that we've done. And so we're seeing more kids move through the system. I don't believe you could make the case that we have more kids in need than they do, but the data suggests we're actually moving more kids that are being referred through the system. When we went through this in the task force, we looked at all 50 states. The one thing that was evident was there is no state that has this figured out. And you see ups and downs, but what you see is that's really based on the robustness of the system and how they can handle the need. When we look across the country, the fact of the matter is there's just a lot of kids in need, and depending on which side you fall on this, I've had advocates say we're not bringing enough kids in because we're leaving kids in the cracks, and other ones have said we're bringing in too many. So it's hard to get to that number. Okay. Thank you, Representative Quam. Great question.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Crescia, the workforce stability study, can you let me know why that's done biannually?
Representative Crescia.
Which study are you referring to?
Representative Cagle.
On line 1.8. Okay. The first section, it says child welfare workforce stability study repeated biannually.
And I'm
Representative Frisco.
And I'm actually going to let Dr. Laliberti help me out on this one. She's more familiar with that.
Dr. Laliberti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
when it was initially written into the bill, it was written as biannually, and that's incorrect. It's been amended to be biennial. So it's being conducted every 2 years. Actually, anywhere in the bill where it says biannual, it will say biennial. And it's being repeated every 2 years at this point in time because our turnover rates are so incredibly high. We want to be able to look at the be able to do evaluation around whether or not what we're doing is effective and efficient.
Representative Cagle. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Crescia for bringing this bill forward. This is, like, way overdue. But that's, it's here, so I want to thank you for that. I have a few questions, but to the testifier, you mentioned something about 60 trained, and I didn't hear the rest of that. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Representative Crescia or Dr. Lalaverty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, the number 60 is that under the new proposal, we would move in Minnesota from a training system to a training academy. 14 staff would grow to 60 staff, and we believe that those staff would be located centrally but also regionally in order to meet the needs across the state. And that also positions counties so that they're not having to pay transportation, hotel, overnight stays. At this point, workers are having to come in and stay in the Twin Cities to get a large portion of their training, the majority of that training.
Representative Moran.
Thank you for that, and that's needed too. So I think to Representative Kwan's question about, you know, why we have so many kids coming into the system, and there's many reasons why we do. One, we have untrained social workers who are erring on the side of safety, so they're pulling more kids into the system, and with that come their biases and how they see the world, that is bringing more kids into the system, and yes, there's higher referrals because of that. And so we have a lot of kids who are moving into the system who are away from their families. I was wondering about the appropriation, because this need is, like, needed now, but the appropriation doesn't start until 2019. So I'm just wondering why not get this money out into other communities and get DHS staff trained sooner than later.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moran. I believe that we would start the appropriation July 1 of this year, but it would actually be for the next fiscal year. So it would be, as I understand it, this bill would release those funds as of July 1 and start getting everything up and running. So it's as soon as we could possibly get it out.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that means that child protection workers will be training this year in 2018. And either you or the doctor can respond.
And they would be training as soon as we get everything. I mean, we still have to work through the cogs of the system, which is appropriation, get DHS to help move the money and get it dispersed. But working with known partners, it would be up as feasibly quickly as possible. And Dr. Lalaverty may have a comment on that.
Dr. Lalaverty.
So if you look at the final slide, while it has the appropriations at the bottom, it also has this phased approach. So new staff would be added. All the training actually takes place through DHS at this point in time, and the university has a different role. Additional staff would be added immediately through DHS and could accommodate additional training to reduce that wait list. Representative Crescia talked about the wait list. If you're hired today, you don't start training until August. That's because there's a wait list, and there just are not enough bodies to do the training that's required in the field at this point in time. There's a statute. DHS is out of statutory compliance at this point because workers have to receive their training within the first 6 months, and that's just physically not possible. So some of that would be accounted for immediately under the current training and the current structure. The rest of those little people that you see on the third line there that are being brought in will start the development of the full academy and bringing in the new curriculum and developing that curriculum, as well as bringing in the other learning modalities and creating the sites, the regional sites and the central hub. So it's a both and. It's a start some additional training immediately while also building what it is that we're moving towards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and finally, I just want to say this is just hugely needed. You know, we do have lots of children been pulled out of their homes. We don't have the family support, you know, that families need. The caseloads are backed up in the courts, and so they've been, you know, separated for a very long time. And then, of course, we do not have staff who are trained to do the work they need to do around the state. And most important to me, we have a disproportionate number of African-American kids who have been pulled out of their homes and are lingering. And bless social workers, you know, bless them. But they're lingering in homes with strangers. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important that we get this money out as soon as possible, get the process moving and rolling, and get social workers trained, and then do a study. I think it's all comprehensive and needs to be done. So thank you. I'm going to sign on to this.
Good.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I also am very, very interested in this proposal. And I just had a couple of questions, and some of them have been answered by other people's questions. But I know one of the problems that we have in the state in a lot of sectors is just a shortage of workers. And a couple things about that. One, the gentleman that came up who's talked about having not been trained until pretty far into his job, and that kind of ties in with you just need bodies on the ground, and it's hard to release people to do the training they need. And, of course, we need them trained to really do the work. It's really a tough thing. But what is the thinking about where these new people are going to come from? Do we have people who have these skills? Do we have to train the trainers to get this thing going? Are we going to pull people off the work? I mean, maybe we, there's just this conundrum. I really like the idea, but is the idea ultimately that people get trained before they actually get put out there with families when the thing is completely up and running?
Representative Frisha.
I'm going to have my testifier.
Dr. Lattelberty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the best training really is to be able to get upfront training and then be able to get cases with lower risk that's involved to be able to have workers under supervision and under mentorship to start to demonstrate that skill and to be able to move through. This training system and the approach that we're taking does allow for that. The reality is counties have autonomy in terms of how they go forward. There's guidance from the state, but counties can and have to assign cases depending on what level of crisis they're in. So there's a model and then there's reality. I'm trying to think of the first part of your question. Oh, where are we getting the people? There's a reality to the fact that we're competing with other human service fields for the same people who are educated, hopefully, as social workers or in other human service fields. The people that are coming into the training academy now are a variety of people, which makes the training very difficult because as people are starting in, if you have people who come from family social science or social work, they will have already had as undergrads or as graduates some information and some education around assessment and engagement and those kinds of things. We have people coming into the training academy who are switching careers, who were English teachers, who were postmen, and they're qualifying and being hired for jobs, and they could be the best case managers in the world once they get up and trained. But training those folks and training an incoming social worker is a different deal. And that's an added challenge to what the state is facing right now in their current training. So all of those things are at play. Most of the counties, if they had a more stringent hiring protocol, maybe they only hired graduate-level social workers like Hennepin and Ramsey at one time did, they've all released those at this point in time because they are struggling to be able to find the applicants to be able to bring them in and get hired. And so it's pretty standard. People are hired with human service or related degrees, and they don't necessarily come with any experience, depending upon where you are in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. And I was kind of also really focused on where the trainers are going to come from.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dr. Laliberti.
The trainers will be hired from a variety of places, but the trainers do typically come from the field because the best trainers are the people that can talk about their experience and know what it is to deliver that service. And historically, that is how the state has hired folks. It is an open hiring. But it's a balance. We try to balance between who has the skills, and we're augmenting and changing the training modality. And so you're going to have people that have expertise in training and less expertise in child welfare and vice versa. And together as a team, we believe that will really emblazon what we're currently trying to do. So you're right. In some ways, we will pick from an already very fragile workforce in order to get the best trainers, but that's also part of the investment.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 2996? Seeing none, any final members? All right, please make your way down. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rich Gehrman. I'm the director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota. We are an advocacy group in the child welfare arena, and what we basically do is we train advocates, and they're your constituents, and they come and talk to you about improvements and more resources for the system. And we're here today to testify in support of the Child Welfare Training Academy as one of the stakeholders in the advocacy community. I was a member of the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection, and we asked the state and the counties to do many things, make improvements, and expand their capacity. I think it's evident that the training is a really basic tool that they need in order to do their job. We think that Dr. Laliberti's center and the department have done an excellent job of putting this proposal together. It's really well done, very well thought out, and it gets 50% federal financial participation, so you get double the impact for the state dollars. So for all these and other reasons, we just wanted to add our voice to this and say that we really support the good job they've done in putting this proposal together, and we encourage you to support it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Gehrman. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 2996? Seeing none, any final questions from members for Representative Kreshaw? Final word, Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Those that have been around and seen the bills I've carried, I've been fortunate to carry a number of bills that I believe have made a difference. I will tell you, and oftentimes I will mask my seriousness with my humor, but this is probably one of the most important bills I've ever carried. And I say that because looking back at all the issues for the task force and everything we've done, they all come back to the people problem. And the fact of the matter is we're dealing with families, we're dealing with kids, and we need to get the people right. When I look at this, this addresses, I won't say it fixes, but it certainly addresses almost every issue that I continually hear. Cultural bias and implicit bias. The fact that we need to know what it's like when we go into those families, and we need to have like backgrounds when they're talking to the families and the kids. We need workers. We know that we have too many cases on these workers' backs. We know that we're not getting folks into the system fast enough. Referrals. For the reforms that we put in place, we have seen an incredible spike of referrals. What that means is the system is not asking for more kids to come in, but people who are mandated reporters are bringing more kids in the system. They're seeing more things. They're more aware of the things that we know are affecting kids' lives, and they're referring those, and so we have to handle that. Reducing caseloads. And the last thing is, this cannot be minimized. We, from everything that I've read and talked about, when you get into ACEs, it's the longevity of the ACEs and not the intensity. So the longer these kids are in, the more days they're spending in these traumatic situations without us reducing that trauma, they're being at risk, and they're continually pushing these problems into the next generation. So if I just go through the long laundry list of all the things that I have heard, this is the one bill that I believe, this is the one thing that starts to address all of those and starts to make a real difference. And frankly, the investment's not that much. The investment's right on target. I know many people, when we start talking budget items, it's difficult to prioritize, but if you break down the investment on this one and what we're getting back from the federal government, this one just makes a lot of sense.
With that, Representative Creature renews his motion that House File 2996 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And House File 2996 is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Thank you, Representative Creature.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Dr. Laliberti. Up next is Representative Keel with House File 2920. Representative Keel, as she makes her way forward, moves that House File 2920 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House File 2920 was brought to me by Episcopal Church Home. The bill increases the skilled nursing facility property rate for the Episcopal Home through the existing moratorium exception appropriation. A number of years ago, the Episcopal Home completed renovations to better serve elders in the St. Paul Midway area. Unfortunately, this renovation put them at a property rate maximum. Having reached the maximum and the current rules, the state property system does not fully recognize the cost and the debt associated with maintaining and improving an older building. This makes it difficult for the Episcopal Homes to make necessary improvements to best serve its clients and the broader community. At this time, I would like to ask Marvin Plackett from Episcopal Church Home to provide testimony in support of House File 2920.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Plackett. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marvin Plackett. I'm the CEO of Episcopal Homes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am here today on behalf of Episcopal Church Home, a skilled nursing facility for which we are seeking a property rate adjustment. A little background on Episcopal Homes. Episcopal Homes of Minnesota is a nonprofit organization that has served St. Paul for 125 years. We provide 475 jobs on University Avenue. On our St. Paul campus, we operate two skilled nursing facilities, and the older is Episcopal Church Home, which has 131 private rooms, 36 of which are dedicated to transitional care for those that have just come from a hospital stay. Annually, we serve just over 1,200 elderly, and 500 are served at Episcopal Church Home. It is for this skilled nursing facility that we are seeking consideration for special legislation. In 2005, our board of directors had a vision to significantly improve an older 1960s-era nursing home. In 2008, we remodeled the older style nursing home with long wings and nurse stations into smaller size households. The costs of these improvements pushed us beyond our property rate limit. The reason for my testimony today is to request your help. Minnesota's skilled nursing facility property rate setting system does not adequately support the costs associated with maintaining or improving our older building. In fact, the rate setting system does not even cover our current debt. For 10 years, we have depended on other revenue streams to cover that gap. Today, however, we are faced with a new challenge. Nursing home use trends are changing. Transitional care demands are decreasing, payments have been flat, and the increasing costs to maintain and improve this older building are all impacting our financial situation. For example, we are currently undertaking a $1.5 million improvement due to the current property rate system. We are unable to recover any of the capital that we invest in this project or building. Two important facts to consider. One, the money sought would not impact the state budget since this funding would come through the portion of the existing state moratorium exception funding that is unused. And two, the property rate adjustment requested is $7.55 per patient day added to our Episcopal Church Home property rate. To put this proposed rate adjustment into perspective, our newer nursing home has a property rate of $45 per patient day, whereas at Episcopal Church Home, our current property rate is only $16 per patient day. In summary, Episcopal Church Home is an important anchor in St. Paul. At Episcopal Church Home, we provide restorative services to 500 elders annually and provide 200 jobs. In order to help us remain strong and vibrant, We need your help to maintain our physical plant and to plan for the future. Thank you for listening. I again ask for your support of HF2920. Thank you for giving this request your thoughtful consideration, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Paquette, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. This is an area of our committee's jurisdiction that is really confusing to most of us. So, you know, by asking a question, I'm not intending to express an opinion on your bill. But why is your facility, I mean, you have an older facility, you've explained that, but there are lots of older facilities around the state. Why is you're here as for an exception? You're here with a bill to change something just for your facility. Why is your facility different from other older facilities around the state that might need the same thing, or is it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I cannot speak for everybody in our industry because there are a few hundred nursing homes in Minnesota. What I can say is that we find ourselves in this tough spot of exceeding our property portion rate caps. And it's complicated. I totally agree with you how complicated the rate setting system is for nursing homes. And I'm not an expert. All I know is that we are exceeding it, and I'm focused on trying to solve our problem. And I don't have an explanation for everybody else in the industry.
Representative Lively.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if there's somebody here from DHS who could kind of come to the table and give us a little more context, because maybe the aging committee understands this better than I do, but having even been through this kind of thing a lot of times and had a lot of explanations from Mr. Held, who's not with the department any longer, it's still really complicated, and I think a little context would be helpful to all of us.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Cook. I am the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at the department. I could give you a little background, as I would agree with everyone that the property system is extremely complex. We just completed a property study that the legislative report has been submitted, and our property system, I think we're all in agreement, is outdated and needs some work, and so we had an extensive stakeholder process that's gone on for the last year or two. There was an investment made that all the nursing homes in Minnesota were appraised for a rental value. And so where we're at with that stage right now is that we're continuing our work with the stakeholder committees and plan and continue to develop the pieces of that system that would modernize it, I guess, so to speak. And we would be in a better position to set rates that would be closer to the actual value of the buildings.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I'm glad to know that there's some, you know, big picture work, and I kind of remember that there was more, system-wide work being done on this. But I guess I read here that the department is neutral on the bill. But if we're to pass, you know, as long as I've been here, we've had these sort of one-off nursing home bills for this, that, or the other. And I always wonder if we're doing the right thing for the overall picture. So if we go ahead and pass this bill, does it impact the overall work that's being done? I mean, do we start to give people exceptions to the cap just because they know a legislator and come in and ask? Is that, you know, how does that change what the big proposal that's going to come forward at some point?
Director Cook.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, so the financial impact of this bill, it will have a zero fiscal note, so there will not be a fiscal note attached to it. So in effect, what's happening with that is it reduces the amount of the moratorium exception dollars that are available going into the next round. And so we estimate that this project is probably about $140,000 annually. And what we have for typically an annual moratorium exception round is about $1 million. And so we will still have a balance of about $800,000 for consideration for the next round of projects.
Representative Quigley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you for that. And I just wonder, finally, you know, how do different facilities, you know, it seems like right now we have this exception process which involves finding a legislator and coming forward with a bill. And I can only assume that not everybody knows that that's what they have to do. You know, it's kind of doesn't strike me as a really efficient and good and fair system because, you know, is there a way that the department kind of lets people know that this is happening so that everybody has sort of the same opportunity to come forward and have their facilities need met in that way?
Director Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. So annually we publish a request for proposals for these larger construction projects. And that is a competitive process, and we issue that in about July of each year. And so all nursing homes are put on notice at that point that they can consider developing a proposal. And then there's a committee where they present their proposals, and so we go through that selection process. So by far, I would say that most of the major projects are funded and through that process.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2920? Seeing none, final questions for Representative Keel members? Final word, Representative Keel.
Members, I thank you very much and ask you to support the bill.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 2920 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2920 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel. Up next, we have Representative Zerwas in House File 3172. As Representative Zerwas makes his way forward, I will move that House File 3172 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill in front of us. I understand you have the A1 amendment.
If you would be willing to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, that would be appreciated.
And I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill into the form that the author would wish to present the bill. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3172 was brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association. Under current law, if a registered predatory offender is admitted to a nursing home or assisted living facility, the facility must be notified. This bill would apply that same requirement when a registered predatory offender begins home care services. And so we have one testifier. We have Kevin Goodnow here from the Minnesota Home Care Association to go in depth on the legislation.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Goodnow. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association. There's not a whole lot more detail to go into other than what Representative Zerwas already went through, but I just want to stand before you and just support, from the perspective of the Minnesota Home Care Association, express our support for the bill and the need for notification when a predatory offender is being admitted for service under a home care agency.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Goodnow? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3172? Seeing none, are there any questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is for Representative Zerwas or Commissioner Goodnow, but have we had incidents that because of this? Is that what's driving the bill, that people didn't know something that they should have known that would have helped?
Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we're not aware of any specific incident, bad incident that happened that would start this, but we are aware of when this legislation was put into effect. And the requirement is really when we're notified, then we can put it into the care plan, and when we send people out to serve the individual. They'd be notified of that. We could put the proper notifications with, around that as we go out. So no headline story that generated this one, Representative Liebling.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Goodnow, is this something that the bill is requiring the notice? And, you know, I don't have any problem with that. It seems reasonable. But I'm just kind of curious, is it right now, is it optional, or are they not allowed to be notified?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there's no requirement that they are notified. So it, there, you know.
Representative Liebling.
I guess it would be optional then.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like putting it in law kind of, it's the checklist that they go down, here's who we have to talk to, so maybe it is that they wouldn't even think of notifying. And just, you know, just another kind of question about that is that, is it going to be, is there going to be any issue about knowing who to notify, or is this going to be something where they'll just, it'll be obvious who should be notified?
Mr.
Chairman and Representative Liebling, I think it should be obvious as to who's notified when they're admitted for home care services, but this bill is also going to the Public Safety Committee for discussion there, and they would have a better perspective on the notification side of it rather than on the side, the recipient side of it from the home care perspective.
Representative Liebling, are there any other questions for Representative Zerwas or Mr. Goodnow? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you for the committee's time.
With that, I will renew my motion that House Bill 3172, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security, Policy, and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3172 is referred as amended to the Committee on Public Safety and Security, Policy, and Finance. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Finally today, members, House File 3312. I will move that House File 3312 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. And members, the intent is to vote on this bill at 10 o'clock or sooner. If we get through all the testimony by then, we do have a list of people testifying. We will try to keep equal time for those who are in favor of the bill and those who have concerns with the bill. I would ask members to keep their questions to items relating to health and human services, and I would expect the same from the people who are testifying today, that health and human services, the area that we have jurisdiction on, will be the areas that are covered. If that's not the case, we will not continue with that testimony. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Members, House File 3312 is a bill that would update Minnesota's Health Records Act to allow for the exchange of medical information under specific purposes permitted by HIPAA, but would retain requirements within the Health Records Act for entities and purposes not specifically authorized by HIPAA. The Minnesota Health Records Act was originally passed over three decades ago, prior to HIPAA or any other federal rules governing protected health information was ever enacted. It has only had minor revisions over the course of the last 30 years, even though our healthcare expectations from patients, healthcare plans, and healthcare delivery is drastically different than when when the Health Records Act was first implemented. Members, this is a good bill. The bill is patient-centered. The overwhelming majority of patients want and expect that their information pertaining to their health care is shared with their health care team. It avoids duplicative procedures and facilitates informed decision-making about care and treatment options. This bill helps health care be more cost-efficient. The ability to share health information with permitted entities like providers, insurance carriers, and care coordinators is critical in helping consumers and lawmakers address the ever-increasing cost of health care. An example, members, is that Allina did a study that many of you are aware of that found by focusing on the flow of information, and making sure that just within their emergency department, the proper information about prior care history and treatment and procedures performed, having that information available in just 2% of their emergency department visits in four metro area hospitals prevented 560 diagnostic procedures in 6 months from being repeated. That's $175,000 in unnecessary and unneeded tests that were able to be avoided just because the information was available to the provider to see that that test had already been performed. This bill promotes innovation. The bill, the ability to leverage clinical information is critical for quality improvement. The opportunity to innovate with new technology is unnecessarily complicated by the consent infrastructure that exists in the outdated MHRA statute. In achieving true interoperability of electronic medical records is contingent on the ability to exchange clinical information. In the ALINA study that I just mentioned, that flow of information only occurred in 2% of the cases. Just 2% of the cases in their ED visits at those four hospitals. If we could improve that number to 25%, or just say in half the cases, that patients that go to an emergency room, the physician that treats them knows what tests that they had performed and knew their full medical history. If we did that in just half of emergency room visits, we could easily see savings to our state health system that exceed $90 million a year. We're talking real money to be saved just by allowing my providers to talk to each other. That's all we're asking. You may hear that passing this bill will weaken patient privacy and that the Minnesota Health Record Act safeguards medical information in this state. The reality is that the MHRA, but HIPAA, and other federal regulations that require providers to safeguard and protect security of patient information. And those laws carry serious penalties. And when those requirements are not met, those penalties would still remain. Nothing in this bill would change penalties under 144.298 of this chapter. Those penalties remain. There appears to be a lot of misinformation circling about what this bill will do or what this bill will not do. I have some attorneys here who are happy to take questions and provide some further testimony, but let's be very clear. We will not be repealing privacy protections. That's fake news. It's fake news, members. We will not do that if we pass this bill. There are very specific and limited instances under federal HIPAA when the release of information is permitted and to whom it's permitted and for what purpose. That exception exists in 48 other states. We don't have crises in 48 other states. Members, the clinical information and sharing that occurs under current law is a faulty process at best. We've engineered a system where we assume no to sharing information when patients expect yes. If I go to a doctor and I'm referred to a specialist, I expect that my doctor can talk to my specialist. If I collapse and I'm sent to a hospital by ambulance, I assume the doctor at the emergency room can find out about my congestive heart defect and my 10 prior open heart surgeries. But under today's old, archaic, outdated laws, that despite the ability to have a completely electronic health record, our 30-year-old laws prevent that. And so what happens? Well, this winter, when I found out that I needed to have an interventional cardiac procedure to look at some changing condition in my heart, I went from my cardiologist to an interventional cardiologist. And you know what they had to do? Because I had one appointment time, and it was my first time there, and I didn't have all the documentation set up. They redid all the tests that were done a month prior. And then 4 weeks later, I went to a new hospital to have that procedure done. And guess what? They redid the analysis of my pacemaker for a third time in weeks prior to doing that test. Now listen, I meet my out-of-pocket deductible every year. So thank you, Blue Cross. But guys, this is nuts. This is nuts. So we have to do better to take what is an old and antiquated system of managing health records and bring it into the 21st century to meet patient expectations. In your packets, you will find a letter of support that has been signed by 50 organizations, including medical providers, patient advocacy groups, long-term care providers, business interests. The breadth of the stakeholders illustrates the importance of this issue. You will also see a letter from the health law section of the Minnesota Bar Association, which also supports this legislation. Members, the coalition has been formed. The tide is changing. Patient expectations are that providers can take care of patients in a seamless manner. We should assume providers can talk to each other when taking care of patients. That's all this bill does. I think there are some testifiers.
All right, Representative Zerwas, do you have any testifiers?
I do, Mr. Chair. If we can start with testifiers, I'm not sure what order they're in, but however
you'd
like.
Whichever order you would like your testifiers and Representative Zerwas.
We'll take our testifiers in the order in which they signed up.
Okay, then we'll start with Mr. Bowerman. And after Mr. Bowerman, we'll have Mr. Mulder, then Mr. Graves. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present us with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Bierman from Lakeville and now living in Prior Lake. Woo-hoo. I'm here in favor of House File number 3312. A rare disease has taken my career and many of the activities I enjoyed with family and friends. Receiving this kind of news is devastating. I didn't ask for it, but it is my life. Specialized medicine has allowed me to seek answers from different centers, like I have at the University of Minnesota, the ALS Clinic, but I also maintain my primary care in Burnsville at the Park Nicollet Clinic. I've also had a second opinion at Mayo Clinic. And right now, I hope my phone buzzes and that I'm notified that I'm selected for a clinical trial in San Diego that could save my life, but more importantly, lead to a cure so my children don't have to worry about every twitching muscle. And I pray that our privacy laws haven't jeopardized my position. Sorry for being emotional, but this is my life, and I need you to know that with all these multiple options, it's critical that my care team has access to all of my medical records. But our laws have made that difficult and time-consuming. when my test results are updated or my medication's changed, I need to have my care team know that, but rarely does that happen. In fact, when I went down to the Mayo Clinic a few years ago, I learned that I had to pick up all of my records. It took me several weeks to collect them and the data and my scans and hand deliver them to Mayo Clinic so that I would know that they would have all the information they needed. The requirement to obtain my consent appears, you know, to be a security issue and a measure. But in reality, it seems more like a secrecy issue that compromises my provider's ability to care for my complex illness. It shouldn't be this hard, and the burden shouldn't fall upon myself or my family. Amending the state's Health Care Records Act to allow providers to share information efficiently would help my care team, and it would help me. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity, and I urge you to pass House File 3312.
Thank you, Mr. Bierman, for your testimony today. We'll get through all of the in favor and then pause for a moment of questions for any of the testifiers that were there. Mr. Mulder, if you could please make your way forward, and then we'll have Mr. Graves, Mr. Nessie, and Mr. Martin after that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Mulder, and I'm the president and CEO of Hutchinson Health in Hutchinson, Minnesota. Hutchinson Health operates a 66-bed hospital, 123-bed skilled nursing facility, and clinics in McLeod and Meeker counties. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its 142 hospitals and health system members to speak in strong support of House File 3312. In addition to leading Hutchinson Health as its president since 2009, I'm also a family medicine physician, practicing for more than 36 years. I had the opportunity to serve as the medical director of the Hutchinson Health Emergency Department from 1999 to 2009. I've cared for thousands of patients and have made quality and patient safety key components of my career. From the emergency room perspective, I know firsthand the importance of being able to access patient information quickly. Sometimes the need can be as simple as accessing everyday health information from a patient's health record, and sometimes it can be a critical factor in the patient's clinical outcome. There's little question in my mind that the dual requirements of HIPAA and the Minnesota Health Records Act are adding costs to our healthcare system and hindering better care coordination for our patients. Originally passed in 1996, HIPAA was significantly updated in 2013. The updates included changes to the security rule and breach notification portions of the HITECH Act. Additionally, the definition of significant harm to an individual in the analysis of a breach was updated to provide more scrutiny to covered entities with the intent of disclosing breaches that previously were unreported. Previously, an organization needed proof that harm had occurred, whereas now organizations must prove that harm has not occurred. More severe penalties for violation of personal health information privacy requirements were also included. I tell you this because today you will likely hear from opponents of the legislation that HIPAA has no teeth. This is simply not true. Anyone who believes that HIPAA has no teeth should ask the handful of Hutchinson Health employees who have been disciplined or terminated for violation of HIPAA requirements what they think. HIPAA in its current form has driven a sea change in how we treat the privacy of patient records. In the past, a physician might casually ask a colleague about a patient with an interesting problem and they would have discussed it. Now, if a physician were asked such a question, she would inquire whether the first physician was involved in the patient's care. If the answer were no, she would say, sorry, can't talk about that, HIPAA. Around the halls of Hutchinson Health, you will hear HIPAA invoked multiple times every day. The resources dedicated to staff HIPAA training and to investigation of possible violations are significant. We do not begrudge those costs because they have significantly improved data privacy. But my top concern is for the patient. Let me share an example of how Minnesota's Health Records Act has stifled our ability to provide better care coordination for our patients. I was working in the emergency room caring for a patient with shortness of breath and a buildup of fluid in the lungs. The patient related they had been an inpatient at a metro hospital the week before and had lots of tests. We called the metro hospital for those records and were told that we needed to fax a written consent from the patient to release them. By now, the patient had been become quite confused and fatigued due to low oxygen levels and could not sign the consent. Her husband had to go home and do some chores, so we had no one else to sign. We ended up treating the symptoms as best we could with limited knowledge of the underlying pathology, which would have been easily available from the Metro Hospital's records. Ultimately, the patient recovered, but you can easily see how flying blind in such cases could have serious implications. In addition to enhancing care coordination, the ability to share health information is critical to reducing the cost of health care for consumers and enhancing safety for patients. Every time a test has to be repeated, it not only adds cost, but it also adds greater risk for our patients. Our patients often expect that their health information is being shared with their care team and are perplexed to learn that our current system prevents this. Being able to assume that patients want their doctor to share health information with other appropriate health care professionals will lead to better care for our patients. Minnesota's health care providers should be allowed to share information as permitted under federal law, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Mulder, for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Mr. Graves and then Mr. Martin to finish up the in favor side. Mr. Graves, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As many of you know, the Minnesota Chambers, we have 2,300 members across the state, every corner of the state, every industry in the state, representing over 500,000 employees. We work on healthcare issues because it's a significant cost concern for our members. We have entered into this conversation about the Health Records Act because it has been identified, as Representative Zerwas said, as a significant cost driver in our system. I want to just quickly bring your attention to one of the things that's in your handout, which is a summary of a peer-reviewed scientific study that Allina did several years ago in which they tracked the cost, or I guess tracked the downside to the inability to share information amongst providers and coordinate care. In just four of their emergency rooms over a six-month period, they were able to receive relevant health information to coordinate care in only 2% of cases. And when they were able to access that information, as Representative Zerwas mentioned earlier, they were able to avoid 560 duplicative diagnostic procedures. The cost of those duplicative tests were just under $200,000. More importantly, though, if you take those numbers and extrapolate them out over the state, as Representative Zerwas mentioned earlier, that savings very quickly adds up to nearing $100 million. It's not every day that we as a business community have the opportunity to get behind an initiative to both better coordinate care, lead to better patient outcomes, and also save $100 million or more in our healthcare system. So I would strongly encourage you to look favorably on this legislation, give it your support, and we look forward to working with all of you and the many, many stakeholder groups that are engaged in this legislative priority. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Graves, for your testimony this morning. Next, and concluding the proponents, Green Martin or Sarah Kilgard, whoever you happen to be. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. So,
hi, my name is Kareen Martin. There's a lot of you. All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of House File 3312. My name is Kareen Martin, and I am the Chief Privacy Officer for Allina Health. As Chief Privacy Officer for Allina Health, I am generally responsible for all things privacy. So what does that mean? Contrary to what the term implies, privacy is not just about locking down data. That would be easy. And if you think about it, no one would ever use information for anything, and nothing would ever get done. So instead, privacy is a broader and more complex concept, one which addresses the appropriate collection, handling, and use of information. As a healthcare system, the appropriate collection, handling, and use of information in our world is largely governed by state and federal privacy laws and regulations. I am dedicated, both as a professional whose entire job revolves around the laws and regulations, and as someone who deeply and personally believes in privacy principles, to ensuring not only compliance with law, but more importantly, to ensuring that we honor the trust patients place in us to protect the confidentiality of their health information. So, if I'm such a big privacy advocate, you may be asking, why am I here to speak to a proposed revision to the Minnesota Health Records Act, which removes the requirement to obtain patient consent for certain disclosures? There are three reasons. One, the MHRA consent requirement creates unnecessary barriers and frustrations for patients. Two, the consent requirement creates barriers to providers in care. And three, it creates unnecessary administrative requirements for systems. I'll address each of these in turn. First, the fact that the requirement creates unnecessary barriers and frustrations for patients. So as you heard already, patients expect that health information is shared among their providers. You've heard very powerful stories from individuals who've been impacted by the MHRA requirement for patient consent. Those stories are not unique. Patients are often frustrated, confused, and thwarted by the consent requirement, even if they don't fully know or understand why. For me, I had a significant health issue several years ago. My primary care provider referred me to a specialist who I needed to see right away. And when your doctor tells you you need to go see a specialist, an oncologist, hematologist, right away, that's advice that you usually follow. So I called the oncologist to schedule an appointment, and I was told that I needed to send my records to the doctor. To do this, the nice lady told me I needed to sign a consent. She would email the form to me, I would print the form, sign it, and fax it back to her. No problem. I hung up the phone and immediately and completely fell apart, sobbing at my dining room table. I, for the life of me, could not figure out how to do these three simple things. My printer never works. I don't think I have a scanner. And I definitely don't have a fax machine. I tried to get the app for the fax machine and couldn't figure that out either. So here I was. I was sick, scared, overwhelmed, anxious about my diagnosis. All I wanted to do was get in and see the doctor right away. And the one thing that I couldn't do was figure out how to sign this consent form to get the records to my physician. If this was overwhelming for me as a healthcare lawyer who spends her entire career dedicated to these sort of regulations and requirements, I cannot possibly imagine the impact that the consent requirement has on people who aren't lawyers, on the elderly, on people who, like me, never have a printer that's working, or people just who are generally not technologically savvy. At a time when patients are hurt, scared, and confused, we should be doing everything that we can to make things easier for them and not more difficult. The second reason to remove the consent requirement is that it creates unnecessary barriers for providers in care. So you've already heard from one provider today as to how the consent requirement impacts providers, where we are perhaps not able to obtain all of the records that are needed to provide good and well-informed care and decision-making. The other piece, though, is that not having the complete picture, the complete record, may result in duplicative testing due to the not having the record. This creates two issues. So the first is an unnecessary cost for patients, particularly those with high deductible health plans, or where an insurer refuses to pay for the second test or service because they already paid for it the first time. The second is, of course, an unnecessary cost for payers. I personally experienced this. So after falling apart at my dining room table, I did what any reasonable person would do, and I picked myself up and I went in to see my hematologist oncologist without my records. And when I got there, because I didn't have the records, he said, well, I need to have your records so I can see what the outcome of these or what the results in these tests were. And you have two options. You can either go away, get the records, and come back, or I can just rerun the test right now. And I wanted the information right away, so I said, go ahead and rerun the test. He reran the test, and then I personally paid for those tests out of pocket. So this sort of thing happens all the time, but again, people who don't live and breathe in this space don't fully appreciate or understand why they're being billed for repeat tests. They don't understand that often it relates back to the consent requirement and the inability for the provider to have all of the records at the time that they're providing care. The third reason that we should remove the consent requirement is that it creates unnecessary administrative costs, barriers, and inefficiencies for providers and systems. So, you know, you think about it, that we at Allina, it's a large organization, have an entire staff of people like myself, compliance people, privacy people, lawyers, health information management, all dedicated to fulfilling the requirements of the consent requirement under the Minnesota Health Records Act. But the state of Minnesota has many, many, many providers who aren't Allina, who are small providers, who is a solo practitioner as a dentist, and they don't have lawyers and compliance officers on staff, and they have to meet the requirement for the consent, which, again, I can only imagine is very expensive and frustrating for those smaller providers. In short, as a chief privacy officer, a privacy lawyer, and an individual who firmly believes in privacy principles, I have the utmost confidence in the privacy protections under HIPAA. And I truly believe that the consent requirements for certain disclosures under the Minnesota Health Records Act and removing those consent requirements would benefit not only patients, but providers and healthcare systems as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Martin, for your testimony. Members, I apologize. There is one more testifier in favor of the bill. Mr. Nessie, if you could please make your way forward. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lucas Nessie. I'm the Director of Health Policy for the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Minnesota Business Partnership is a membership organization that consists of the CEOs of Minnesota's largest employers. Our health policy members include the CEOs of Health Partners, Allina, Children's Hospital, Gillette's Children's Specialty Clinics, and Mayo Clinic, among many others. In 2015, the Minnesota Business Partnership worked with McKinsey to essentially assess Minnesota's health care relative to other states. And the conclusion was that we're doing very well, but obviously cost remains a challenge. The cost and cost growth is a challenge for employers just as it is a challenge for your state biannual budget. And you've heard a lot of compelling testimony and expert testimony, so I'll simply conclude and say that we are proud to be one of the more than 50 organizations that have signed on in support of this bill as a step that you can take to promote efficient, coordinated care that can be delivered at lower cost.
Thank you, Mr. Nessie, for your testimony. That concludes those speaking in favor of House Bill 3312. We do have a couple of questions that we'll move into for these. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my wife's been was the head of the Byron First Responders for about 10 years. And everyone on that squad will tell you that time saves lives and that information saves time and lives. And for me, it is silly and stupid to think that if I make an appointment or a referral with a practitioner, that I'm not wanting them and implicitly giving them the right to my records. And with me, it's an inconvenience, maybe a cost, but it's easy to understand that for some people, it may delay a diagnosis that could cost them their life, and it definitely could cause a lot of people to have a much worse condition. Things go on, and it doesn't get good on its own. And frankly, it's about time that we look at fixing the problem, because I can't see anyone without, if you got common sense, why would you want to see a doctor and not have them know your medical history, what tests, etc.? That's why you're going there. And we got to do something.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zirwas. Very often we are up here working together on policy as policymakers in a way that we think about the whole state of Minnesota, and this is one of those things. I'm new to this committee, so many of you guys haven't gotten the pleasure of hearing me state, and you now will over and over again, that very good studies at the state and federal level repeatedly say that about 30% of the spending in our healthcare system is waste. Repeated tests are duplicative and unnecessary, and this is one of the number one things that drives that 30% waste. And so if we have an opportunity to attack that head on, what we can do for employers and individuals who are purchasing insurance is huge. But sometimes policymaking is personal. And I saw Representative Zerwas's passion talking about this, and I was nodding along excitedly because I have type 1 diabetes. And Representative Zerwas and I won't speak for you, but either one of us could show up somewhere unconscious at any given time. And we need fast and accurate care. And so we get excited about this when we think about our own lives and we think about staying healthy and alive for our kids and those kinds of things. And there is pain associated with those duplicative tests as well. Many of you know that one of the most horrible times in my life happened when I was serving as a member of this body, and my son was hospitalized. Well, he was sick with a mystery illness for months, and we saw way over 12 specialists. We went to three different healthcare systems in the state of Minnesota, and I had to hold that baby on my lap while he screamed, "No, Mommy," for test after test after test that had to be repeated every time we moved systems. And so this is really good for the state of Minnesota. This is really good for people like Representative Zerwas, myself, like the other testifiers who are looking for life-saving measures for our health and for our futures. And this needs to be taken really seriously for both of those reasons, for patient care and for the cost in our system. I will also say I really was happy to hear the doctor say that HIPAA is taken seriously. I've worked in the healthcare industry, and it's amazing how often you hear that term many times a day as well. And so for those of you who don't get to live and breathe in that world, it's something that I've experienced as well. One thing that I did want to ask Representative Zerwas, if you could confirm for me, I believe that this recommendation changing Minnesota's laws to be compliant with HIPAA, to be compliant with federal law, was part of the healthcare financing task force that a number of members participated in a few years ago.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, I did not serve on the healthcare financing task force, but I've seen several heads nod yes. So I'm getting that secondhand, but others are indicating that it was a recommendation.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, a lot of times, especially I think in health and human services, anecdotes and emotion drive policy. And, you know, I think we all agree that, you know, we all want the absolute best care for patients. And the real issue, I think, is will this bill solve the problems that are being laid out here? When we talk about privacy, I think there are difficult balances to be made. I am really a privacy advocate. It's really important to me, and I am willing to, you know, make changes in law if it's really, you know, there is a balance to be struck. One of the things that's kind of troubling to me about this whole discussion is that we don't have the whole statute in front of us, folks. And I don't know if maybe the staff could distribute it. But Representative Zerwas, you talked about this being a 30-year-old law. Well, it hasn't been 30 years since changes have been made to it, because I wasn't here 30 years ago when this was passed, and I have been here for changes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the changes are here in the law, and there are exceptions. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm against the bill. I'm kind of undecided on this bill, but this makes me really uncomfortable the way this discussion is going, because it seems like a really all-or-nothing discussion. And your reference to fake news, I think, you know, I think there's a little overspeaking going on here about where we're at right now in Minnesota under current law. Some people have referred to, like, oh, if you're in the emergency room and you can't get, you know, and you're, I think the physician here talked about that. We made a specific exception in our law for that, I'm not saying this is all working perfectly, but I just have a real concern here, and I know we're going to have people on the other side of this, but you know, the real issue for me is, does the bill actually make a change that you all are looking for? Because I think a lot of the problems we're talking about here aren't really, some of them might be tied to the necessity to make sure you have consent, but some of them I think are about the fact that electronic records don't always talk to each other. We have different systems. There are different problems, different medical systems, or people in an emergency room may not understand the law. So I just want us to walk through this a little more carefully, because there are really important interests on both sides of this, and it's important not to let our emotion about, you know, we all want to have the best treatment. But right now, when I go to Mayo Clinic, they ask me to sign something that gives consent, and then the consent is given, and it's there. You know, so, you know, as we go forward here, I just want to be really careful that we're not driven by, let's throw out what we've got because it's causing all these problems. It may be causing some problems. Maybe the fix we need is a little bit more careful fix. And let me just say, too, that I have a concern, and Representative Zerwas, you may want to address this now or later, but the way this bill is drafted, you're not throwing out the whole law. You're just making a huge hole in it, as I see it, kind of just saying if it's under HIPAA, you can go to HIPAA, but you're not getting rid of the rest of it. I don't understand why it's structured in this way, because our exceptions will still be there. I don't know how all that interacts. So, you know, it's too bad we don't have a whole lot more time for this discussion, because I think it really merits it. So I'm going to stop there. I just want us to be really careful, because I don't think that the horror stories about our current law are necessarily caused by our current law. And Mr. Chair, would it be possible for members to get, maybe if we have time, or even emailed out, a copy of the actual statute that we're amending here? Because we've only got a little piece of it in the bill.
Thank you for that, Representative Liebling. We will get a copy of the statute emailed out to members so they have that for reference. Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I know that Representative Liebling doesn't believe that the consent portion of the Minnesota Health Records Act contributes a significant portion, or maybe isn't as big of a deal with some of the problems that patients and providers are encountering and duplicative deaths and adding to costs for health care. I guess what I would point to, members, is the 50 organizations that have signed on to support this bill, the CEOs of all major hospital systems that disagree with Representative Liebling.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Zerwas, I don't really, it makes me uncomfortable when you tell people what I believe, because I think you misstated what I'm saying.
Please, so, you know, clarify.
And the idea that we should all agree, we should all do something because other people say we should, I fundamentally reject that. I think every member has a responsibility to think about what they're being asked to do. And, of course, we take people's opinions and their reasons for those opinions into consideration. But just to say here we have a list of people, therefore it must be okay, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Zerwas.
I don't have a list of people. I have every hospital system, every insurance system, every 30-plus patient advocacy systems that are advocating for this. I didn't talk to 50 people off the street. We have the greatest concentration of healthcare experts in the state of Minnesota that have come together and decided that this change in legislation will help patient care, help patient continuity, and reduce healthcare costs. That's not me saying it. I believe it. But that's not me saying it. It's 50 organizations led by some of the most influential and informed people in the healthcare system in the state of Minnesota. So don't misrepresent what I'm trying to say. I didn't get a few people to sign a piece of paper. We have every single CEO of every major healthcare system.
All right. With that, we'll move to testifiers who are speaking with concerns on the bill. Those that spoke in favor went from 9:18 to 9:36. That was 18 minutes. We will give 18 minutes, or up to 18 minutes, for those who are speaking with concerns today. And we will conclude with questions and then go to a vote. So, members, we will go over our time by just a little bit. The order for those who signed up to speak with concerns include Mr. Flanders, Mr. Feinwalk, and Mr. Neumeister. If you could please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the legislative specialist with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on House File 3312, and I will share a few of our concerns about this bill, which I've already shared with the author. First, at CCHF, we believe that privacy is critical to patient care and the patient trust necessary for timely, accurate medical care. Furthermore, as CMS Administrator Seema Verma said Tuesday at the HIMSS conference, the largest healthcare conference in the world, it's our data, it's our personal information, and we should control it. For several decades, Minnesota has done just that. We've led the way in giving patients consent, patients control by giving them consent rights over data sharing and use. But this bill seeks to circumvent our law, eliminating the patient's right to give or refuse consent. It puts clinics, hospitals, and health plans in control of who will access, see, and analyze, and use the patient's data. Most people think HIPAA protects privacy, but in a 2010 rule, HHS lists 2.2 million entities, including 1.5 million business associates, that can have access to their data without consent if the ones holding the data choose to share it. Also, according to Mayo Clinic's Notice of Privacy Practices, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Florida, and Georgia require patient consent for medical research. HIPAA doesn't. For the sake of time, I will just direct you to the document included in your packet to review how Minnesota consent laws are similar to other states. Again, it's our data, and consent protects our claims over the use of the data. According to healthit.gov, HIPAA is just the floor for the treatment of data. Under the state preemption section of HIPAA, stronger state privacy and consent laws are allowed. For example, the definition of healthcare operations is nearly 400 words long. Under HIPAA, patient data can be shared for all of these activities without consent, but not under Minnesota law. We have heard that this bill just conforms us to the HIPAA standard, but what is that standard? According to the National Governors Association regarding the sharing of data through an HIO, or health information organization, quote, a no-consent HIO model abides by the HIPAA standard and automatically shares or stores patient information without obtaining patient consent for participation, end quote. Simply put, the proposed HIPAA standard is a no-consent standard, a no-privacy standard. We have also heard that this bill will reduce health care costs for two reasons. First, due to the administrative burden of adhering to the Minnesota Health Records Act and getting that consent. However, a 2017 Department of Health report included in your packet revealed the cost reported by providers to be an average of 83 cents per patient. And second, due to the cost of duplicate tests. The proponent's claim regarding duplicate tests is interesting for a few reasons. First, in 2007, Allina released a report stating that as a result of implementing electronic medical records, quote, duplicate testing has been virtually eliminated, end quote. Our privacy and consent law has been in place before and after that statement. Second, in 2012, the study that Allina did, which formed a 2014 report, revealed that in the less than 2% of the instances this new tool called Care Everywhere was used, 560 duplicate tests were avoided. But this report also notes, quote, caution should be used when extrapolating the results of this study. Third, if the Minnesota Health Records Act is responsible for duplicate tests, as alleged, and if Minnesota is one of only two states not following the no-consent HIPAA standard, why did CMS Administrator Seema Verma on Tuesday declare that CMS will, quote, be studying ways to reduce duplicate and unnecessary testing, end quote? If the other 48 states are conformed to the HIPAA no-consent standard, why is duplicate testing still a national problem? In closing, this bill essentially dismantles our state privacy law, eliminating the privacy and consent controls Minnesotans have today over the use, sharing, sale, and distribution of their data. Therefore, we ask this committee to vote no on House File 3312. And I thank you and the author of this bill for hearing our concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Flanders. And just before you go, I just had one question on clarification. Yes. Just on one of your handouts, it says states requiring consent according to Mayo Clinic. That is a document from you, correct?
That is correct. And the quotes are all taken directly from Mayo Clinic's Notice of Privacy Practices, which I'm happy to provide to the committee if they would like.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Flanders.
Thank you.
Next, Mr. Finewalks. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Finewalks. I reside in the city of St. Paul. I have an interest in this issue and some background. I'm not here on behalf of any organization, but I would note that I teach health law and policy at the University of Minnesota, and I was for 30 years general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. I tell you this for two reasons. One, because it's true, and two, because they hate when I say that. let me begin by saying that there are a number of questions that we must consider here, and one, we must begin with whose data is it? Now, this is not a question to be taken lightly, because I do not mean to, nor will I demean the testimony of anyone who has had a negative experience in our healthcare system, who's experienced frustration, who's had a delay or suffered confusion or has serious healthcare problems. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to point out that the information we're talking about belongs to the patient and not the healthcare provider. Number two, any patient who desires to avail themselves of care coordination or any other kind of integrated, automated, electronic service is a signature away from doing so. So the question is, must those who do not be compelled to do so? And just so you understand the way the world operates at this time, organizations like Health Partners, for example, when you go there, they will present you with a form. And that form says that you waive your rights under Minnesota law. You waive them. And if you don't sign the form, they'll cancel your appointment. There'll be no future appointments. Now, is that legal? I don't know. It's never been challenged in the courts. But for those of us who say, okay, I'll find a different provider, we have the opportunity to do that. So the ownership of the information is important. Secondly, there has been testimony about 48 states and costs. So ask yourself, this is Minnesota. Minnesota is the nation's leader in health care. Whatever else you think about us and about health care, this is Minnesota. We're damn good at it. And we got some fantastic providers. So these 48 other states that are not encumbered with our privacy laws, have they significantly reduced the cost of health care? Are people living longer? Have they cured cancer? Has the ravages of dementia been exterminated? Doesn't exist anymore? Are they so much better than we are because they have HIPAA and HIPAA only, which is a floor and not a ceiling? HIPAA is a floor. Here's what HIPAA gives you. HIPAA gives you the red line on the floor of the pharmacy at Target so that when you stand behind it, you won't hear the person in front of you screaming about why Medica won't pay for their prescription. Okay? That's what HIPAA gives you. That's HIPAA's idea of privacy. Now, let me tell you something else that HIPAA won't. That HIPAA allows that is extremely important, and you're not going to hear talked about. You're not going to hear talked about today, except probably by me. In 2012, some of you were here, others read the newspaper to remember, there was an organization in Minnesota that did business called Accretive Health. And Accretive Health was a revenue cycle management company, which is a fancy term for bill collectors. Now, Accretive Health was doing business with Fairview, and our attorney general ran them out of the state. They were banished for 6 years. That was in 2012. Now it's 2018. The 6 years are up. There's two ways you can collect medical debt bills. You can call the poor patient who owes the hospital a bunch of money at dinner time and say, Mr. Smith, you owe the hospital a bunch of money, and we would greatly appreciate it if you pay. And if you don't, we're going to be forced to take legal action against you, and this is a debt collection call, and that happens all the time, and that's appropriate. Or you can have a bill collector have access to medical records without the patient's consent with a business affiliation agreement under HIPAA. And if you have that, here's how that phone call goes. Mr. Smith, we see you were treated at Fairview Health Services for chemical dependency. Be a damn shame if somebody called up your employer and told them you were a junkie or a drunk. So you better pay that bill. Now, as an issue of policy, you need to decide if you think the latter scenario is appropriate, because I certainly don't. And in addition to all of these things, you have to confront the fact that, as you well know, public policy is like a game of pickup sticks. You don't move one thing without affecting something else. Let me tell you a story. This is a true story that I experienced during my 30 years of representing the Hospital Association. One day I got a call from a hospital. A local pharmacy had been the victim of a robbery. Law enforcement contacted the hospital and said, "We need the names and addresses of every person who's been treated at your facility for chemical dependency during the past 18 months. I said, "Tell them no." I got a call from the county attorney. I said, "Look, under Minnesota law, we don't recognize your subpoena power. We don't issue that based on an administrative request. You're going to need to get a search warrant." And the gentleman said to me, and I quote, "No judge would ever give me such a search warrant." And I said, "Yes, sir, that's my point." So if you want to change these things, if you want to set up a scenario where people are drawn into this system against their wishes, then vote for this. But if you want to keep Minnesota's leadership as not only one of the best places for medical quality of care, but also protect your patient privacy, then you need to have some caution about this, because this is a dangerous game, and there's much more here than meets the eye. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwalks, for your testimony today. Finally today, we have our final testifier today is Mr. Neumeister. And Mr. Neumeister, you have about 7 minutes.
Mr. Schumacher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm a privacy advocate. I am not paid, and I've been doing this for quite a long time, to where when I look around the room, and I've been in the forefront of privacy issues, I see Mr. Renner of the Minnesota Medical Association, who represented them then and represents them now, who 32 years ago I was fighting to where we as Minnesotans have a right to get access to our medical record and where we can get copies of our own records. The health industry opposed that bill, but policymakers and a couple of people like myself got that right. And here, 32 years later, the issue is still there. Now, Mr. Chairman, and some of the discussion that's been held today about, oh, we have a problem here. We need better coordination of care and all those kinds of things. If there's a problem, let's deal with the problem and do solutions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been involved in almost every solution when the health industry has come up with a problem. And it wasn't in 1980, it wasn't just in 1990, it was not just in 2000. And, Mr. Chairman, as your colleague, Representative Liebling, has indicated, we, in, as Minnesotans and you as policymakers, have come up to the challenge to where you don't eviscerate or gut Minnesota's strong privacy laws of consent, and where I, the individual, along with your constituents and with their family, decide where to share their most intimate information. Because once it's out, it's gone. And now, like then, for example, if someone does not want a particular intimate detail of something from 20, 30, maybe even 10 years ago, and they're going to a provider that they know has no need for it, they themselves, under our law, are given some choices. Now, in 2007, when the recodification happened with a colleague of yours, Representative Thiessen, great numbers of folks said, well, and HIPAA was already there, let's do some things. And there were changes into law to allow more quicker access to information and all that. Mr. Chairman, if you can tell me when I got about 2 minutes left, I'd be obliged to you. I can't help it that the providers didn't do those kinds of things or whatever. They want easy, kinds of things to do. So the overall thing on that point is cautious. Let's work on some things. You've already been talked about that HIPAA is a baseline. And it's a baseline towards interest of providing information to business associates and providers without, from my view, ensuring the privacy of Minnesotans. Covered entities and business entities are a lot more folks than what you may review. What the bill's asking you to do is 40 pages plus of CFR 45, Part 164, Subpart E. I encourage you to read it, because what it does, it got some of the protections. Now, there's been the issue about law enforcement, and it's been hinted a little bit. One of the things, and it's just one of the many entities, that when you review the permissive info that can go out at request of state agencies, regulated agencies that regulate the health industry, and law enforcement, and other characters, there are more information being able to give out than what our current law allows. Our current law, like what say with law enforcement, and then I'll just define what law enforcement is according to HIPAA. Nope, I thought I had it here. Law enforcement official means an officer or employee of any agency or authority of the United States, a state, territory, or political subdivision of a state or territory, goes on and on, to investigate or conduct an official inquiry, prosecute, or otherwise, various kinds of things. It's a very broad definition.
2 minutes, Mr. Newmeister. Okay.
And some of the exceptions, if you take a look, which has already been talked about, our general law says you can't get anything without a court order or a warrant, and then with the reporting statute. And there was an issue, again, to bring about how people work together. The mental health community, law enforcement came together several years ago, and if you look at, I'm trying to think, 144.294, I believe, or 5, there's a whole section in there where mental health information can be released and all that, because we in Minnesota take our privacy of interest and concern. So when you take a look at the exceptions for law enforcement, administrative subpoenas, administrative requests, what are all those things? And how are people going to determine that? Is there a concern here? You bet there is. And the previous speaker spoke to that. Finally, I wanted to be able to say that there are a number of things that are important here, and I think that Representative Liebling, Mr. Chairman, spoke about it. Throughout the statutes is sprinkled words 144.291 through 144.298, where when you made the decision to protect people's privacy in that particular area, you put that. And when you make this change in law, it will have also an impact in all those other kinds of situations. Secondly, I think it's important in the long run just to believe that we as individuals have the ability to control where our information is. We should not let an industry, a business, or whatever tell us where our most intimate data should go to. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Newmeister, and especially for keeping in time. We will close public testimony now and move to final member questions. I have Representatives Albright and Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple questions, and the first one would go for Ms. Martin.
Your question, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Martin, I'm looking at one of the documents or the handouts that was provided by the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I'm just wanting for you to respond to an assertion in the second paragraph that is made, and I'll read it for you, that says, the business community health data industry and the Minnesota Department of Health want to repeal these protective provisions to allow full sharing of patient data without patient consent. I'm just wondering, in light of your position within a very large healthcare system, and part of my response is rhetorical, but I'm shocked that you intend to share data with the rest of the world based upon your support of the repeal of this provision. So if you want to respond with regard to how Allina would respond to that statement made by this organization.
Ms. Martin.
Representative, thanks for the question. So the response to that is that the proposed revisions do not completely repeal the Minnesota Health Records Act. In response to Representative Liebling's questions about why is this structured, why is this change structured this way, it is structured to continue to have the greatest protections and provisions in the Minnesota Health Records Act remain in place, for example, the right to a private cause of action, but to add the or to remove the requirement for a consent for certain very limited exceptions. And so this isn't we're going to open Pandora's box and suddenly everybody's data is going everywhere. We already practice under HIPAA, and HIPAA has very prescriptive, limited, great detail. I have my dude's binder here that I have to consult every day about what information can be released, when, under what circumstances, to whom. And we're always we're held to minimum necessary, at least for payment and operations. So the answer is that it is not all of this data that is suddenly going to be shared with the entire world. Contrary to popular belief, as a health system, our intent is not to willfully and happily hand over health records to law enforcement willy-nilly. We intend to follow the very detailed guidance in HIPAA that narrowly constructs when data can be shared and under what circumstances.
Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I think we've heard some assertions in the last few days about the idea of private health information. If we follow HIPAA, private health information being used or sold to third-party telemarketers or third-party persons for telemarketing or sales. That is an example of fake news. That is not accurate. It is specifically not allowed in HIPAA to release information under HIPAA. A covered entity can share protected health information for marketing and sale only if it has obtained the individual's prior written authorization to do so. So the idea that if we pass this bill that your doctor is going to sell your PHI so someone can telemarket a new drug or a new replacement knee or joint to you, that is not accurate. That is a gross misrepresentation of HIPAA, and that's already prohibited under current federal law.
Any other questions from members? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question on the information that can get exchanged right now is defined in one of our handouts here as minimum necessary. Question is, who and how defines what is minimum necessary, and does this bill change that?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, I'm Sarah Carlgard. I'm privacy counsel at Allina Health System. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The minimum necessary rule is contained within the HIPAA standard. It is not a concept contained in the Minnesota Health Records Act. But essentially what it says is that for many of the disclosures that are permitted by HIPAA, or payment and healthcare operations, health systems in disclosing that information are required to limit the disclosure of the information to only that information which is necessary to accomplish the purpose. And we're required as a system to evaluate that and understand that limitation.
Representative Olson.
So it's pretty, thank you, Mr. Chair, so it's pretty defined already in given this does not actually touch that because it's a part of HIPAA.
Absolutely. It's very well defined, and it is addressed specifically in HIPAA.
Representative Frisia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just be brief, Ms. Martin, to the testifier. One statement that I heard was that people are being drawn into the system, like there's sirens wooing these people off the streets to come in, and then we're getting their consent. What I actually have witnessed in my medical experience is that, and if I'm ahead of my skis on this, and I'm asking you because you have the legal authority, but it's almost, to me, it seems like when you walk in the door, there's an implied consent that you're going to do this, that there's a reasonable expectation that that medical facility is going to do everything in their power to help you, and once you set that appointment, make that appointment, you're accepting that consent. So it seems to me, I mean, it's not like people are walking in the door with the Heisman saying, nope, I don't want to consent to this, but when I leave, I want my ailment to be gone. So I just thinking in terms of basic contracts, I mean, would that be a fair statement that you're walking in the door expecting to get a product or a service with some implied consent and accepting that for treatment?
I do. This is
Ms. Carlgaard.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Representative, I completely agree with that characterization, and truly the statistics show that 99% of our patients who come in do sign that consent. And what is really important to understand about that is that the law, the way that it's written now, the Minnesota Health Records Act and the consent requirement, caters to that 1% that withhold their consent. And it completely uproots and makes everything that our health systems do custom and catering to that 1% that have withheld their consent. Some not even knowingly, right? Some just withhold their consent because it feels uncomfortable, it looks like a legal document. But at the end of the day, anyone you talk to, almost anyone you talk to, says, I want my provider to have absolutely everything available to them to provide care to me. And so I think that that is where the statistics and the number of individuals who are supporting this really show that the time has changed and that we really need to begin to make Minnesota a player in this space and not a state where every single technology relating to health records has to be customized because of this unique consent requirement.
Final question, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I just want to be really clear. I'm not opposed to this. I'm just really trying to figure out how to balance these interests. So could somebody explain to me, maybe the last testifier, the way the bill is drafted, what is really left of the Minnesota health privacy law? Because it looks to me like, I don't understand why it's being drafted this way, and I want to understand if this bill becomes law, what is left?
Yeah.
Ms. Carlgaard.
I'd love to. Thank you, Representative. Truly, this bill is structured in such a way to allow for a handful of very well-defined and clearly articulated and detailed rights to be able to disclose, permissions to disclose for certain activities, treatment, payment, and healthcare operations for those entities who are subject to HIPAA. There are providers who are not subject to HIPAA. The Minnesota Health Records Act remains in identical text for those entities under this bill. And that's the reason it's written this way. It is not an entire replacement of HIPAA by any means. It is only allowing those disclosures that are allowed under subpart E to be permissive without consent for those entities who are subject already to the entirety of HIPAA, the monstrous security rule, the monstrous privacy rule, all of the requirements that are already in there remain intact.
So thank you. So for those that this applies, maybe I could ask staff, whoever, I don't know who drafted the bill, could you just tell us, for those entities that are subject to HIPAA, if this bill would become law, is there anything left in the Minnesota health privacy law that is still there operating that gives us something additional beyond HIPAA?
Ms. Parkvist?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think I'd have to go through like a complete section by section look at the Health Records Act to answer your question completely. But for example, I think the research section in the Health Records Act still applies. You still would have to get individual consent to release data for research purposes under the Health Records Act. And I think that the penalty section in 144
298 still apply? Those are two that I know off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for indulging me. And, you know, I know we have to move on with the bill, but this bill has another stop. This is not going to go straight to the floor or anything like that. It probably can use some more work, at least. If I could ask staff, I think that would be very important information for us to understand as the bill moves forward, because it is drafted in such a way, and it does impact a lot of things, and I know we just have barely scratched the surface. So that would be my request, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
With that, Representative Zerwas renews. That House File 30. Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Just briefly. Mr. Chair and members, I will be brief. We've heard about Minnesota being a health care leader in a leading state, and that we're one of two states that have this extra prescription, and 48 states do not. The Health Records Act has been in place for 3 decades. Members, after 30 years, if we're a leader, how come we're the only two states? If you're leading the way and you look behind and no one else is following, you're not a leader. It's time we make the change.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3312 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 3312 is referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. With that, I apologize, members, for taking us 25 minutes over time, and we'll try and do better for you next week. With that, we are